one of the biggest reasons that they start to see me is initially it's because they want to lose weight. They want to lean out, get more muscle, lose a little bit of body fat. And then as we delve into it a little bit more, I actually say to them, what's your real priority? Because it's not just losing. I mean, everybody would love to look a little bit better sometimes. Some people are very involved and just go, oh, I look great anyway. That's fantastic. However, most corporate athletes don't feel, because they're high achievers and high performers, they don't feel they look the part. So a lot of them sort of come in, we have that discussion and go, oh, actually what I really prioritize is that next promotion, or I want a seat at the board table. I want to be able to stand up and present. And so what we find is that they're blocked in that way because of, yes, the mindset blocks around it. They don't feel they look the part, but they also physically can't compete. They can't get up there and get to that next level because they're emotionally drained, physically drained. They're overwhelmed because they haven't slept. And of course they're drained because they're not eating effectively and efficiently.
I guess like a really cool place to start is a bit about what you do with your business. And I want to start from maybe the younger years, like what made you interested in what you're currently doing?
I do get actually asked this question a fair amount, even when I'm presenting. And the answer in itself is actually a little bit convoluted, but I'll try and get to the point as quickly as possible. For me personally, and my development stemmed from being Gen X. So that's typically anyone born between 1965 and 1980. And being a Gen X, we are a subset of people who have had a lot on our plate, right? So figuratively speaking. And with that comes, we're typically called the sandwich generation. And the reason we're the sandwich generation is because we have the pressures of our work, our career, but we've also got younger people that we're sort of taking care of, and we've got aging parents that we're also looking after, which is quite unique as aside from the baby boomers and millennials. And so when I was growing up, I had a fun childhood, a slightly difficult childhood, and I was exposed to a lot of things quite quickly. But one of the things I was exposed to was the psychology of people. That's one side of it. And the other side is exposed to financial insecurity. And so I wanted to understand, right, well, you know, how could I eventually bring those two together? It wasn't something I thought of straight away, but it was almost like, okay, so, and that's the early stages. I was like, how do I put this together anyway? In my early 20s, just like most Gen X, and the rise of capitalism, of course, most of us then got into corporate roles. And that fed that financial insecurity quite well. Also because I really needed to feed that financial insecurity, and a lot of us did at that stage. My undergrad degree was in psychology, and so I went into university thinking I wanted to be a psychologist, and then veered into the path of sort of organizational psychology. So I was always interested in corporates and executives. And then through some difficulties in my family home, I ended up just working straight into corporate just to make money, knowing that in the background, psychology was sort of bubbling, going, this is really fascinating. How do these people work? Now, in my 20s, as I started growing into that executive role, into that corporate role, and also keeping in mind that I was, you know, I'm a Gen X female too. So a lot of it was like, you have to be strong. You know, you can't care about anyone else. There's no one else other than you. You need to take care of. So a lot of pressures, right, for us poor Gen Xers. But anyway, And so I moved into watching the people around me, both male and female, really struggling with keeping their health up and keeping themselves energized and actually putting themselves as a priority. And, you know, back then that wasn't a thing. You know, you never were a priority. Our priority was making money, feeding our families if we had them, and pleasing the boss, right? So a lot of corporates and executives sort of fell into that role. And so I also found myself feeding a lot of unhealthy habits in my early to mid-20s around that corporate executive role. And I, you know, my roles were quite senior at a very young age too, so there was a lot that I was exposed to. And then later on, I just went, woof. And when I say later on, it was sort of mid-20s, I went, I can't do this. This is ridiculous. I'm watching the people around me, you know, with heart attacks, obesity, and it felt really wrong and unhealthy for me. To sort of go down that path. So I sort of went back to what I knew around my health and what I loved and enjoyed. And then I started dabbling in nutrition. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Nutrition isn't just about how you can structure a meal plan or what type of foods you need to eat. It's more around, oh, I can get energy from that, or I can start eating around my training goals so I can get better gains at the gym, that sort of stuff. So that was really interesting for me. And so then, you know, fast forwarding a few years, my work started to encompass a lot more of that. So I then took my degree in human nutrition from Deakin University, and then decided, right, this is where I want to be. I want to be a nutritionist. It wasn't until a couple of years after that that I went, actually, I don't want to be a nutritionist. I want to be a really specific nutritionist for the demographic that I grew up with and the demographic that I know. And funnily enough, it's the demographic that is drawn to me and I'm drawn to them as well. And that is your young, busy professional, high achiever, corporate athlete. And so in a nutshell,
corporate athlete,
the corporate athlete,
what's an example of that?
By definition, the corporate athlete is, very similar to an elite athlete in that
they sprint with their suit on, do they?
Yes, they run with their suits on. They deliver, you know, a constant winning performance consistently. So it's right. Somebody who's working in a high-pressure role, delivering consistently high-performance results. The biggest difference, though, between, and I wrote an article on this on the blog as well a couple of months ago, was the biggest difference between an elite athlete and a corporate athlete is very marked, though. The difference being, corporate athletes, you know, don't have coaches. They get a limited amount of rest time. They work excessive hours. They don't get much sleep. They don't get good nutrition, unlike elite athletes who are fed professionally. You know, so there's these marked difference. However, their expectations are the same. They need to perform at a high level consistently. So that actually makes up the bulk of my demographic and my clients.
Wow. And I think that if you were to put some trackers on a corporate athlete and, you know, an athlete, you would find many similar metrics, probably not so much intensity in one hit for, you know, two or three times a day as far as workouts go, but rather like, you know, preparing for that big meeting, yes, those stressful situations. And not that I'm in a corporate space, but for me, running a business full time and doing 6-7 days a week on a regular basis,
yeah,
there's times where like I'm wearing a Whoop. Okay, I track my resting heart rate, my heart rate variability, my sleep, and all those things, and stress. And like an example of this, and I'll use myself as an example, and feel free to take pokes at me for things I might be doing wrong. But if I'm working right, or feedback on what you do with your clients. But if I'm working throughout the day and I'm having lots of stressful, high stress situations, and I don't eat well, and I don't look after my body as far as like do my morning meditation or, you know, take breaks throughout the day, my sleep the night after will be, I'll wake up after 4 hours. If I do that for weeks on end, it's like I'm chaotic in a mess. And we all know how much stress impacts us, but what does that look like for someone who, you know, in a corporate role, I'm imagining, I'm putting my assumptions on there, but they're having like fast food, quick food, driving through Macca's on the way to work, you know, like going out for you know, booze and lunch and all those things. How does that impact their performance, and what do you usually do to help them come back to a place of health?
Oh, great question. It's an interesting one, because they all differ individually, but the trend is typically that their performance declines. And one of the biggest reasons that they start to see me is, initially it's because they want to lose weight. They want to lean out, get more muscle, lose a little bit of body fat. And then as we delve into it a little bit more, I actually say to them, what's your real priority? Because it's not just losing. I mean, everybody would love to look a little bit better sometimes. Some people are very bold and just go, oh, I look great anyway. That's fantastic. However, most corporate athletes don't feel, because they're high achievers and high performers, they don't feel they look the part. So a lot of them sort of come in, we have that discussion and go, oh, actually what I really prioritize is that next promotion, or I want a seat at the board table. I want to be able to stand up and present. And so what we find is that they're blocked in that way because of, yes, the mindset blocks around that. They don't feel they look the part, but they also physically can't compete. They can't get up there and get to that next level because they're emotionally drained, physically drained. They're overwhelmed because they haven't slept. And of course they're drained because they're not eating effectively and efficiently. And then, you know, the flip side of the ones that aren't training or aren't doing some form of exercise, I have ones that overtrain. So they could have been ex-athletes growing up or they might have played, you know, competitive sport growing up. And so all they know is, if I'm going to live a life where I'm having to sit down X amount of hours in the day, and I'm going to have to go out and have some alcohol and have a few drinks, or I'm going to have to go to corporate lunches and overdo it, I'm going to train twice a day, 7 days a week. And then there's complete burnout. So there's the flip side of that as well. So my job is to find that balance, which is just the worst, right? When we talk about balance, it could be anything, but my job is to help them find the balance of actually eating appropriately, sleeping appropriately, and then training appropriately. And you can see how almost none of that has anything to do with just losing weight or just being a corporate, right? It's just part of being human. However, the mentality that they bring to the table is an athlete. And so a lot of them get great success because they're already almost there. You're not sort of dealing with somebody who doesn't know what it takes to get results. And that's the part that I love. I love working with it. They're very demanding, but I think I can be very demanding. Okay, don't tell anyone that. I've just told the world that. But it's that whole high achiever, and I understand it because I grew up playing sport and I grew up, you know, very competitive in corporate environment in my 20s. So I understand it and I can relate to it. And I think that's where we sort of try and bring it back down. Now, the ones that are relatively overweight, we sort of look at more, not so much the aesthetics around that, but what does that mean, especially if they have young children? And I mean, if you're working a high pressure role and you've already, you know, recognized that on your watch, for example, when you're highly stressed, what does that mean for your stress levels as you get older, as you put on more body fat? Will you be around by the time you're 60? You know, that sort of stuff. So it becomes a little bit more intensive than just that whole, oh, I want to lose weight.
So do you experience, do you cover the psychological side, meaning that, you know, sometimes people are eating for reasons outside of what you mentioned? Like, I know for me, like I will occasionally, if I'm really stressed, and this is also, there's science in this as well based on stress, but if I'm really stressed, like I will see a junk meal as like a reward for my hard work. And like, when really it's actually punishing my body, ironically. So do you have the psychological side that you have to handle as well, or is that rather because you're dealing with high performers, they just take care of it themselves?
No, they definitely don't. That's psychological. It's amazing when they come in here, they're like, okay, just tell me what I have to do and I'll do it. And you know, it's a very, very fluid conversation with us. So yes, absolutely not. What happens with my program and the work that I do, a lot of it is embedded into mindful eating. And mindful eating is eating with intention and attention to your food. And with that comes a myriad of self-awareness that they need to develop, right? A myriad. It's not even, oh, I know what I'm eating. Great, I'll eat it. It's pacing yourself. It's chewing. It's smelling your food. It's tasting your food. It is understanding why you're triggered to eat that food. So a lot of the work that we do initially, And this is just foundational work with what I do. This can go on for the remaining few sessions that they have, or it can go on. I have clients that see me for 2 or 3 years. And it's still something that we have to cover. So, but it's very, very normal, and we normalize it because, you know, it's bringing awareness to that behavior, such as stress eating or emotional eating, doesn't give it any power anymore. And so once we bring awareness to that behavior, then we can work to chip it away. And I like to say divorce the relationship between food and emotion to a degree, especially a negative emotion. And so with that, I talk very openly and candidly around self-empowerment and self-sabotage when it comes to food. And it's your choice. At the end of the day, you choose. So that reward for Maccas, as you were saying, may feel like you are empowering yourself, but I think you know you're self-sabotaging. And part of you may be self-sabotaging because of feelings of self-worth or lack thereof, or because you've had a tough day and you feel you deserve it and something's triggered you to want to eat something that is sort of instant gratification. But there's a part of you that still knows that that's sabotage. So we sort of work through a lot of that stuff as well psychologically. Yeah.
I remember about, I think it was about a year ago, year and a half ago, it was a year ago. And I was building the business that I'm in at the moment. And I was, again, working really long hours and I was rushing my food all the time. And I wasn't aware of the science around eating fast. And I'm massively paraphrasing here, but when you don't chew your foods, the peptides don't get properly broken down, and it sits on the side of your gut lining. It chews away your gut lining, and it can lead to leaky gut and various things like that. On top of that, when you're stressed and you eat, and then hold these, it leads to other host of problems of, you know, your body's pulling the resources away from the gut and other organs to prioritize the blood flow to the limbs of your body, because it's in flight or fight. So I was eating, and I was just like, I was finishing like a whole meal within the space of, you know, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, like just eating, moving forward.
Oh,
I know. And I had a friend at the time who's like, he told me, he's like, you know, when you eat foods, you don't properly digest. The peptides would then sit on the side of your body and then of your gut lining. It then creates, you know, I'm using metaphors here. There's not the literal science, but it creates cracks in the gut lining. And then you have whole food molecules going to your blood, which then triggers an autoimmune response. Hence the, you know, spin outs and like, you know, lightheadedness and sleep issues and various things. So that night when we went and ate, you know, I ate with him, and he eats so slow, like so slow to the point where his food's going cold. Then he stops between his. He's stopping between eats.
I love that. Same? I'm exactly. Yeah. My family clean up around me, and I'm still eating. And
he would sit there, and he would then pause an additional 5 minutes and just like meditate while he's eating the food.
That's not for you.
He's really good. Like he was really good at it. And so I did the same thing, and I had a meal. Every single meal that I ate up until that point, you know, for the last 2 or 3 years prior to that, was followed by like spin outs or like feeling fatigued and, you know, like really, really bad. And so then I would sit there and I ate the meal. I slowed down. I just, oh my, this is torture. I'm like eating it, chewing it for like 30, 40 times.
Mm-hmm.
Then like pausing, putting my knife and fork down. He's there sitting like in some like Zen state, like I'm doing the same thing. And I've been meditating for a long time, but food is not the best relationship that I have with food. And then after the food, right, I felt similar symptoms like start to come on, then go away. Like it was, as opposed to like boom, it's here. The symptoms will come on and go away just from slowing down chewing. So I can certainly attest to that emotional side. And I think a lot of people, if we're looking at it, you know, realistically, how we are supposed to eat, as far as supposed to, meaning generally speaking, as a human, versus how we eat right now with our phones hunched over, like with the food in front of us, is completely wrong. And we're devoid of nature. So I imagine you see that all the time, especially with corporate people, right?
It's actually one of the biggest things we work on. So that no distraction, I do challenge them. They are set homework with me. So after a session on mindful eating, one of their pieces of homework is to actually choose one meal a day at least where they are not distracted or in front of the screen. You know, aside from the obvious fact that you're not paying attention to what you eat when you're in front of a screen, there are studies to show that what you eat, how much you eat, how fast you eat is also triggered by what you may be reading. So for a lot of corporates or executives or entrepreneurs, if you're reading an email that's quite stressful, or you've seen something quite stressful, your natural reaction is to find a reward for that, because or a procrastination technique. And it's typically food. So it could be, you know, chocky, could be lollies, could be a drink for some, you know, so... So that's definitely something that we work on initially, which is breaking the habit of grabbing something or eating in front of a screen. Absolutely. And chewing slowly.
Hey guys, before we dive deeper into this episode, I just wanted to ask a quick question. Are you over worrying about having to create content? Are you over that nagging feeling telling you that you should be posting today? Or I should have posted yesterday, or I should be more consistent with my content? Well, there's no need to worry anymore, because my business, Personify, we focus on helping leaders to grow an online presence. And we do this through content creation. We have a multi-step process where we do all of the clip selection, the strategizing, the uploading of the content, the copyright of the content, the video editing, the graphic design, a whole lot across all 10 platforms. So if you're a business owner out there, or if you're a leader, or if you're someone who has something to say and you don't have to worry about creating all this content, which by the way can take upwards of 30 hours each week, then let us know. We're here to help. You can reach out to me on the website, www.getpersonified.com. GetPersonified.co. It's also in the link below. Peace. I Awesome. And so for those listening, if they want to do it themselves, what would be the best way to approach that? Like, what does one do? You said 1 mil to begin with. Is there like a psychological hack? Because I know people might have issues with, and this is probably why you work with executives, because they're more willing to do it. But people have a hard time pushing through on habits because there's emotional stuff there. Is there like a way to see it that's more appealing, maybe?
Absolutely. It's funny. Look, I love to say that the executives are reward driven and very good at results based behaviors, but not always. And they're humans, right? So they have a lot of, and that's even more difficult in that demographic, in that they, if they have a resistance to something, they're pretty strong at saying no. So one of the ways. Absolutely. So that agreeableness, right, that trait isn't always there because some of them feel very challenged by a new behavior. And so there's a couple of things that we do. One of them is one meal a day doesn't necessarily, similar to Atomic Habits, make it obvious and easy, right, for example, which is if the one meal that you know that you can have one in the day is going to be breakfast, where you're not distracted or in front of a screen, start off with breakfast. For many people, breakfast is the easiest because it's the first meal they have. They're usually with their family or at home getting ready for work or whatnot. And not a lot of people, although my demographic, a little bit aside to that, are always in front of the screen for breakfast. But typically it's the one meal that, it's the first thing in the morning in terms of your eating. And so it's easier to manage. When you get later on in the day, it becomes more exhausting. It's harder to actually follow through with that. And then once they've mastered that after about, I would say, 7 days, then, you know, make it 2 meals that day. And this is where it becomes a little bit hairy because I have a lot of resistance, especially from execs who are, but it's urgent. I have to be answering that email. I have to be on my laptop. I have to check those emails. If I tell you are only allowed 20 minutes a day to eat and then a timer goes off, I'm sure you can find 20 minutes to just sit and eat by yourself. So that's part of, you know, an addition to some of those exercises that we do. And then I think those meals aren't, the meals and the distractions aren't really the challenge for this group and potentially most humans. I think the bigger challenge is what you were saying earlier, which is chewing. And so once we focus on chewing, which I think is one of the best things to actually focus on, it's not so much just distraction-free. It's actually that chewing at least 6 to 10, and then you can go up to 40, which typically you actually have to be doing 40, but I get them to about 6 to 10. And then by the time they know it, the 20 minutes is up and they haven't looked at a thing because they're concentrating so hard on having to chew that mouthful. And so we put those challenges in place as well. And it's really interesting to see that, you know, not only do they start to enjoy their food, but their nervous system, the fight or flight response, diminishes. You know, it starts to rest a little because they're not always feeling on the go. They're feeling a little bit more relaxed.
Yeah, I think that's a natural mechanism of nature. Like if you look at we within ourselves able to regulate ourselves, but also if we look to the external environments that we have typically and built in our culture, we're naturally regulated by our environment, like people, nature, old friend bacterias coming off trees and dogs and various things like that to decrease inflammation, eating food, for example. All these things are supposed to be done in a parasympathetic state, and we've stripped that away with phones and with technology and with the externalization or the pursuit of an external goal at the expense of success or the expense of, sorry, health. So I really hear that. And I look at the literature of some of the things in nature, and it's just incredible how much it helps us and how much it can help us, but we're devoid of those things because of technology and things like that.
Absolutely. And then we go back to that same point about prioritizing yourself. And for many of my clients, they don't feel that they can. This is all prioritizing yourself. It's about putting yourself first. It's about taking those 20 minutes, concentrating on your food, not being distracted by anything else. And a lot of people feel uncomfortable because socially that's how we've been raised. It's almost like, well, who am I to think that I can have 20 minutes in the day to actually have my lunch on my own in peace? I should be responding. I'm a very busy person. I have a lot to do. And that, you know, is a broader side of the work that I do as well. So it's a little bit more complex because it really goes into the psychology of behavior, not so much behavioral eating, but behavior. And then we type behavioral eating into that and how that's associated as well.
Mm.
Just learning to prioritize yourself.
So I'm curious, what do you eat in a day? How does your day start and what do you eat? Give me a rundown.
Oh my gosh, so many questions around that. It's crazy. I do actually eat frequently. And I do, funnily enough, this week I finished up an article around how I structure a meal plan because for years I've been asked. And it doesn't get into the nitty-gritty of exactly what I eat. It's more around what I consider when I'm structuring a meal plan. And meal planning is not the same as meal prepping. So what do I eat really means more to me around the question, how do I structure my day with eating? Mm-hmm. Because those... what I eat and how I structure it for a lot of people can be very different. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I typically have a coffee in the morning. I train fasted. So I usually train semi-fasted aside from the coffee. So then I'll train. I'll do some form of exercise. And then after that, I will have a protein shake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's been something that I've been having for years. And there's so many reasons why I have it. I hate food prep. I hate it. I'm just going to say, right? I just can't stand it. And this is why I get along so well with my clients too, because they come in thinking I'm all about meal prepping and batch cooking, and I'm not. I'm all about simplifying your lifestyle and giving you an easy option, satisfying option, and something that you can do that's going to be sustainable for you. So protein shakes are by far the easiest for me. I can throw everything in there. I'll typically have a mid-morning snack, so that could be a protein bar, or it could be some veggies with hummus or an egg, for example. And then lunch is pretty stock standard. So I talk a lot about in my sessions and in my writing around what we call the power plate or the healthy plate. And so learning how to balance your foods. I think for a lot of people, that feeling of counting macros, knowing your calories, food tracking is really overwhelming, especially when you're busy, because it is time consuming.
It is.
So the way we sort of like to structure it is, you know, think of half of your plate just being non-starchy veg, like capsicum, cucumber, that sort of thing, leafy greens, whatnot, broccoli, quarter of your plate being protein, and then a quarter of your plate being a starch of some sort, if you choose to have starches. And so that's typically what lunch and dinner look like for me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I actually talk a lot about because I find that people overthink it. It's like, just don't make it so complicated. It doesn't have to be a restaurant meal, nor does it have to be fancy. In fact, the more basic you get, the better it's going to be for you. And then I actually have two afternoon snacks. So again, it's always going to be a protein and a carbohydrate of some sort. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, typically for me, that's a few sort of meals a day.
What's an example about the protein and carbohydrate snack? What's an example of that?
So a piece of fruit with Greek yogurt, for example. So you've got the fruit being the carbohydrate, Greek yogurt being the protein. Rice crackers with peanut butter. So you've got some rice crackers and you've got peanut butter being your protein.
And you have Maccas on the weekend.
No, and that's the other thing. It's that sort of restricted, again, what we talk about, that restriction mentality is what that really is. It's allowing yourself, you know, we go back to mindful eating with this, allowing yourself to have a meal that makes you feel happy, but also makes you feel good. And Macca's for a lot of people isn't going to cut it. But what that allows is if we start to break our meals down, for example, if somebody wants to work with me and they say, I just want to cut out all of my carbs, and I'll delve into why that's even a thing for them. And what I find is that they've had a history of cutting out carbs, losing weight, which is predominantly water and muscle mass, and then binging on carbohydrate for months after that, right? And so what I sort of try and bring back into that is, well, let's bring the carbohydrates in. Let's do it sensibly. And let's work around how you can sustain that longer term as opposed to cutting it out completely so that we're not having, you know, binge sessions around carbohydrates, for example.
Mm. And when was the last time you had a bad meal?
Should I have to think about this? Because in Australia, it's coming up to summer, right? So everyone's quite conscious around getting back out there in their swimmers and bikinis and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I've been on a little bit of a program myself. However, I'm trying to think of the last.
There must be something pizza. That you love doing.
No, it must have been. It must have been pizza, and it wasn't just pizza. It wasn't just pizza one night. I think I had pizza three times that week, because of different.
So bad.
Different commitments.
I'm kidding.
No, you're waiting for me to say back. It's not Macca's. It's things like pizza and Prosecco. And I think that week I ended up going, whoa, okay, let's stop. Let's just stop for a minute because I don't feel so good now. And then I had to sort of bring it back for myself and go, well, wait a second, why are we doing this? So it was that bringing it back myself, going, let's be a bit more mindful. What am I wanting to achieve? And I'm the sort of person that works really well under pressure. So if I know that I've got like 2 weeks to do X amount, or if I want to, you know, reduce body fat or build more muscle, I know how to do it. And that's what I'm going to work towards. So it's not, you know, I tie that into that discussion because you may have people who are looking to, especially some of my clients who are looking to lean out a little bit more, become fitter. But if they've got no end goal, and we talk a lot about goals in sessions, if they've got no end goal or they can't see that actually happening, they're never going to change their behavior. So yes, you can have your binge sessions, but just know, right, are you going to be doing this continuously for the next 3, 4, 5 weeks? Or is there a point where you actually want to achieve X, you know, body fat percentage or muscle mass, or you want to, you know, you want your jeans to fit again, or you want to be up presenting in that board meeting and looking how you want to look? So that's kind of where we have to draw the line when it comes to a lot of that behavior.
And is it like you know how people say eat healthy during the week and then you have like one cheat meal, the cheat meal concept? What do you think about that? Like what was that?
The cheat meal. See, I don't love the word cheat meal at all, because why do I need to feel like I'm cheating when I eat? Why?
How would you phrase it then?
Yeah. So it's a treat meal. It's a treat meal for me.
Nice.
And yeah, it's a treat, but a treat meal can mean anything to anybody. A treat meal might mean Macca's to one person, or it may mean a beautiful dinner at a very expensive restaurant. A treat, you know, what that allows for is you're not cheating, you're just treating yourself. And that reward behavior is really important when it comes to food as well. Even though people say we try not to reward, you know, good food behavior or also because it creates unhealthy habits, it's actually essential for us in some ways, because we sort of don't have a reason sometimes, especially for those that love food, innately love food, to want to eat healthy.
What's interesting, because a lot of these, and I'd love to dive into some of these misconceptions if they exist, but a lot of the, you know, information around dieting is to have a cheat meal once a week, to count all your macros, have a certain amount of protein and things like that. So I'd love to dive into some myths. And if you want to skip these, we can, and we can just cut these out in the podcast, FYI. But we can skip it, go into some myths. And the first one would probably be around protein. They say for someone to build muscle mass, this is what I've heard at least, you need to be having around about 1 or 2 grams of protein per kilogram. So if I'm weighing 70 kilograms, I might be having 130 or whatever it is. Is that accurate or is that not so correct?
It's actually true. So I've worked with, because I'm a sports nutritionist as well, I do work with athletes, and we do focus quite heavily on protein. And I pull from that work around protein and work with that with my corporate clients as well. So my executives, because of, again, similar mindsets, depending on your intensity, frequency, duration of training, for example, you need a certain amount of protein. So typically that can be, for some people, depending on the intensity, if you are on the higher end and you are lifting heavy and you want to also gain, you might want to be thinking around having sort of 1.7, 1.8 to 2 grams per body weight. And that's actually, funnily enough, not so much a myth. Where it gets complicated is people understanding how much they need for their body because they aren't 100% sure of what their actual training goal is. So you'll have people that, you know, sort of come to me and be like, I just want to get big. I just want to gain mass. I'm like, what exactly, how much do you want to weigh and how much body fat do you want to lose and how much muscle mass do you want to gain? And they sort of look at me blankly going, oh no, okay, let's just go back a little bit. And so But the one thing I do want to say around protein is we also can't tolerate a lot of protein in one sitting, which is typically why I eat a lot of little meals a day as well. Because
I see.
We
could
probably, yeah. So the bioavailability of protein is limited, depending on the body, but usually around 30 grams. Yeah. So we can usually ingest in one hit around 30 grams. For some people, almost 40, depending on how big you are. And then the rest is used up for other cells and other parts of the body, or it's waste. It's used as waste, or it's gone into your fat cells. So there is a thing where just like carbohydrates, just like fat, if we overeat protein and our body's used up all the protein that it needs, it will transfer to our fat cells as well. So we're going to be conscious of that too. Protein is a big one. It's one I definitely focus on, and not just for people that are wanting to weight lift or gain more mass. Women in particular really undereat protein. And so with undereating on protein, you'll find a lot of sort of hormonal fluctuations leading to that 3 p.m. sugar crash, where they're sort of grabbing for all sorts of things in the afternoon. What's termed as sarcopenia. So from the age of 40 onwards, we actually break down muscle mass, right? So 40 to about 80, we can expect, if we don't do things like eat protein and do resistance training, to break down almost 50% of our muscle mass. And that's not ideal, because for not just aesthetic reasons, where you increase body fat naturally if you've got low muscle, but it can lead to injury as you get older. You can slip, fall, you're not as coordinated, you're not as strong. So there's many reasons why protein actually is quite important in the diet, I feel.
Yeah, and an example of, so I'm in the Philippines at the moment, right? And the big thing about here, especially in non-city areas, like I'm in more provincey area at the moment, it is very hard to find, it's not hard to find, it's just more difficult than Australia. Proteins, because I can't have a I have to order like a protein powder and find the right one. It's just different here. Long story short, I was putting on lots of size about a month ago, and I was like looking really good, like, and I then came here and I'm having all these carbs, and I'm like, I lost so much weight and eating way less as well, and the only source of my protein is meat here, and it's like I don't want to eat meat 3 or 4 times a day to reach that quota. Like if I'm trying to reach 120, you know, grams of protein, I then need to have, you know, 30 grams of sitting. That's 4 meals a day. That's 4 sets of meat. There's not things here like you can't go to the shops and get like a protein shake or, you know, like so it's quite difficult. So I guess off the back end of that, self-serving question as well, but also for people listening, is there strategies or ways of thinking about traveling and still matching those protein intakes that you would suggest or recommendations you might have?
Yeah, very much so. So with a lot of corporates especially, they do a lot of work and travel around Asia. Mm-hmm. And the situation is really similar. There's a couple of ways to mitigate this. First of all, you need to get educated on non-meat sources of protein, right? And really understanding, if you're going to be staying in somewhere like the Philippines or in Asia for extended periods of time, what are their sources of protein that aren't meat? It could be tofu, for example. Could be edamame, right? Yes, and a lot of people don't like tofu. So it's kind of, so we've got that situation too, which is the preference thing. We'll talk about that in a minute. So really educating yourself on, okay, what are the alternatives to meat when it comes to high protein sources? It could be certain lentils. It could be beans. It could be edamame, like I said. And in the Philippines, I mean, they do have other options, you know, eggs, for example. So if you're an egg eater, And so that part of it is you can start to derive aspects of that diet into your diet, incorporating it, where you're not having to eat meat that often. Right. What I also, so that's the whole food part of it. What I also am a huge fan of, and I really talk about this with clients too, is depending on how long you're staying, if you're only staying there for a week, for example, some clients usually travel for a few days or a week, I highly encourage that you take things like your protein powder and your protein bars with you, okay, and a whole heap of it too, right? So, and if you can't get it there, then find sources to order it from. I'll give you a really good example. I was in Greece for a month living out of a hotel room earlier this year on an island, and it's not your typical Mykonos or Santorini, right? So it's somewhat remote. very islandish. One of my sisters and her family live there. And I had run out of protein powder. And with me and my family, protein powder is like, we need it, right? So yeah, because we eat a lot.
Same for me.
Yeah. And so then I had to do my homework, and I sourced a protein powder that got shipped from Athens to the island. So I was like, you know, this is what I need, and I need to do it now, and this is what I need to be eating, right? Because I know also on that island, very limited sources of protein for me. I am vegetarian, so there aren't a lot of things that I can have, and tofu doesn't exist on a Greek island, for example. So it was one of those things, and it did come, which was great. I actually thought it may never have arrived to the island, so it did come. So that's another way of sort of mitigating. It's like doing your research and going, right, what's a major city? Can I research online where I can get my alternative? Yes, there's synthetic versions of protein, but at least I have that support for while I'm away and traveling. Yep. The other part of that is, again, as I said earlier, just doing your research on where you're staying, what type of food they eat. This has happened many times to me because we lived in Asia for 6 years. And
whereabouts?
We were in Singapore for 6 years.
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah. Nice. We did a lot of travel around Asia, and I know it all too well, and I know how limited it can be, even the provinces. And again, just having that understanding around, right, what can I use? What can I eat? You know, are you somewhere where there are easy fish sources or easy plant-based sources of fuel for protein? But what I really do encourage with a lot of the clients is, especially when you're traveling, try and limit the starches, especially the carbohydrate starches, because it's not going to feel so great when you come back. You know, they sort of come back feeling very bloated, possibly having put on a little bit of body fat, feeling very tired, very drained. Yeah.
The food here is very oily as well. You know, I'm hoping they're using coconut oil, but it's very oily and very carb heavy. So it's certainly a challenge, but you're 100% right. There is options there, and it's just about ordering and planning ahead. So I hear that. One last question, or one important question. What are some of the key differences you see? This is more of a, like, I'm interested in the executives you're working with. What are some of the key differences you see in them as individuals versus, you know, other people you're working with on a, you know, different basis? What are some of their, like, assets and some of their negatives, and how can we learn from them if that's possible?
Yeah, great. That's a really good question, actually. I don't think some of them get the credit they deserve. One key thing is the athlete mindset for me. So mm-hmm. as I said earlier, so an athlete mindset is somebody who sets a goal, and it doesn't have to be a difficult goal. It doesn't have to be unachievable. It sets a goal and works towards achieving that. But around that athlete mindset also comes the understanding that there are areas that they're going to have to work harder in, and then mm-hmm. their strengths, they're going to have to work harder to build, right? So the difference between, I suppose, somebody who is in corporate or, you know, having been an ex-athlete, for example, is that athlete mindset versus somebody who doesn't have that athlete mindset. It's that want to achieve. It's that want to get the results. That is also to their detriment, right? Because they're so driven that, you know, sometimes there are times when you have to say to them, that's completely unattainable for the time frame that you want. And you know, second to that, stop beating yourself up around not being able to attain it. Because they're so results and goal orientated, you know, yes, it's great in some ways. In other ways, it can stress them out so much. And stress is a physiological feeling. It's not emotion, right? There are emotional things that go on before you feel stress. They're so stressed out physically that they do develop things like leaky gut because they're eating so fast. And you see how nutrition then taps into all of that. Well, they're so stressed out that they're not eating. So they're surviving in a state of fasting, which in itself is also dangerous. So that's typically, in a nutshell, the biggest difference I see with my clients. It's that athlete mindset and that willingness to get the goal no matter what.
Awesome. I love that. And is there anything else that you're passionate about at the moment? Anything you want to share with the world that's on your mind at the moment that you haven't had a chance to?
Oh my gosh. That's a tough one.
You can take some time to think about it if you want. I'll just stay here and stare at you.
Do you know, the only thing that I'm keen on I love that you say that. I'll sit here and stare at you. Thanks, Luke. The only thing that I'm pretty keen on improving are my surfing skills. You know, I love the sport and I find it an incredibly challenging sport. And I know, you know, it's funny, some people say, oh my gosh, I can't believe she's passionate about this. But, you know, passion comes in all sorts of various forms and whatnot. I grew up, I'll give you some context. I grew up as an artist, actually. And I was, you know, I'm relatively good at art. I was trained oil painter from very early on. But I lack the passion for it. And it, and then, you know, years ago, I got into the surf, got on my first surfboard and went, oh, now this turns me on. And for me, I think it's this, again, this athlete mindset that sort of goes, okay, so I'm relatively good at it, but I want to be better. And for me, that's my passion. It's almost like, how do I work at this to be better? That's just one activity. My other passion is to get my family to a state where we can live permanent part-time on this Greek island with my sister. So that's the other passion project that I'm working on at the moment. So having, you know, a good few months of the year in Sydney, Australia, which I love and adore, and I also get to surf, but also having 4 to 6 months where I can live overseas on this Greek island and just, you know, have a life there.
Wow, that's awesome. And it's funny, isn't it? Because in a weird way, we don't really choose our passions. Like I've had a really hard time grappling with this. Like I remember for the longest time when I was younger, I always felt in a way disillusioned because I'm like, I would try to seek out my passion. I'll read all these books on what's my passion, what's my purpose? And I'd keep trying to find it, keep trying. I'll do these different jobs, buy these different courses, spend like $1,000 on this, $1,000 on that. And it wasn't until I really stepped back and I said to myself, and this happened from having really bad insomnia at one point in my life where I'm like, I couldn't work anymore. I wasn't able to work in this business that I was working in, this startup business that I was doing like 6 days a week and ridiculous hours and all these things. And I had to leave there. I literally physically couldn't work. I couldn't sleep 2 hours a night and go to work the next day. So I would, I said to myself, I said to my boss, like, I can't do this anymore. This is too much for me. And it's like, well, can you work from home? Like, no, I just intuitively feel like I need to just not work. And I said to I remember sitting in my apartment at the time during COVID before the second wave in Sydney of COVID lockdowns. I remember saying to myself, for the next 3 months, I'm going to allow the answers to come to me. I'm going to just stop. I'm going to pause and I'm going to let whatever it is that I need to do come to me. I'm not going to force myself to do anything. And the next day I woke up, didn't do anything. And next day after that, I started going to the gym naturally. I started meditating in the morning. I started buying courses on just random things about things I was interested in. Fast forward 3 months after that, I started to create content online. You know, I started to create videos and for me as well, I'm quite artistic, but not in a traditional sense, not with a pencil or drawing, but I've always felt this desire to create something outside of me and share it with the world, but also make it informative. And that's what I started doing. I started reading science articles and breaking it down. And then fast forward to now, it's led to my business. So I didn't choose that, you know, and I know I did technically speaking, but it was like a force outside of me that led me to that path. And I realized that sometimes to find your passion, it's not about, making it come to you by inquiring into it. It's about letting go and letting it come to you.
Absolutely. And I love that you say that because it completely resonates with me in nutrition. I think for me, I actually didn't choose to be a nutritionist really. It was sort of one of those things where I found myself talking about it, working on it on my own, having people come up to me in my life going, what are you doing? You look amazing. You're on point. And I'm like, oh, just change this, that. This is how I'm training. And this is how I'm focusing and rewiring on work and the roles. And I even had a stint where I just didn't want to do it anymore. And yet I still had people coming to me going, I want to work with you. And I'm like, no, business is closed. Not interested, tired, burnout as always. And then I went, okay, I think this is my jam. And I think the other thing is that resonates for me. And I love that you're bringing this part up around passion is, you know, they say that the best job is in the world and the topic you should really focus on if you're going to have a job is one that you can talk about 24/7. And there are days where I wake up and say it's a weekend and I know that I'm going to a party and I'm just going to say, I'm not going to talk about nutrition today. Even if they ask me, I'm going to try it. And then one thing will be said, you know, this was even a party last Saturday and I'm like, oh, and this verbal diarrhea, and I just love what I'm talking about. And the person's engaged and they want to know more. And then I start talking forever. And then I have to have one of my friends pull me away and says, stop working. I'm like, I can't help it. It's too fun. And I think that's where, you know, you sort of need to land. And I make it sound simplistic, but I think for you and I, we've been through the trenches. I know what I don't like doing to finally find out what I actually love doing.
For sure.
And I know who I don't like working with, to finally find who I love working with. And that's why I think executive nutrition and corporate nutrition and working with busy professionals has been so rewarding for me. You know, they're a little bit harder in many ways.
And for those individuals that are listening right now, where can they find you?
So I run a business called Exec Fuel, Executive Fueling, and you can check out all the details, including the costs of packages, single sessions and whatnot, at the website, execfuel.com.au. I am available on Instagram under Exec Fuel, Facebook, Exec Fuel, YouTube, Exec Fuel. And next year I will also be launching an online program, which I'm very, very excited about and, you know, a little bit nervous about. And that'll be focused and very niche on creating a stronger, leaner, fitter version of yourself through a structured nutrition plan for busy professionals, because it is the one topic that I'm constantly asked. And I think that creating having a self-paced course to do it is ideal for those that don't want to work with me directly.
And when does that come out?
Well, we're hoping Q1 2024, but let's see. I'm hoping Q1 2024, and I'll definitely keep you posted on that one, because it's a project that I have been working on for a while, so I'm quite excited about it. And it's also one of those projects which, can you imagine, and like most people who are entrepreneurs or have athlete mindsets, it's a project. It started, it has to get finished. Otherwise, I will go mad if it doesn't get finished.
That's a part of your plan to go to Greece as well, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely. So it's a stepping stone. I do find a lot of joy in just that discussion part, you know, creating stronger, leaner, fitter, energized executives, because it translates to so much of their other lives around corporate, around their families, around the way they train. And so having a program that encompasses that and having, you know, a couple of calls a month, you know, with the members of the community and really driving that would be absolute heaven for me. And then obviously being in Greece would be even better.
Beautiful. Well, thanks, Camilla. I appreciate it. And everyone, set your alarms for Q1, let's say February 15th, to check in for this.
Some pressure. For that.
And yeah, absolutely awesome to chat with you. I appreciate you being here.
You too, Luke. Thanks so much for having me on here. Love the conversation. And I look forward to speaking to you on more than just podcasts. So yeah.